Hello, I'm Clive Johnson. Welcome to Impact, a podcast about how we can each bring about real change in the world and getting practical in making that happen.
And hello, I'm Ellen Bintz. A special welcome if you're listening for the first time, and a big thank you to our new subscribers. Each week, we look at how we can connect our hearts to offer healing for others with our collective intention, prayers, and meditation, and talk about the critical happenings in our world that need our attention right now. You can hear what news that caught our attention this week in our last episode, but in today's episode, we take one of our regular deep dives into one aspect of intention, healing, and prayer. I am so happy to be talking with Brother Dave, who is also called the Marine Monk. And there are some really, such an interesting background you have, Dave. And thank you. Thank you for being here, first of all. I really
appreciate it. Thanks for having me. Thanks for
talking with me. Dave and I were just talking before we actually started the interview that I was hoping in this time that we have together that he doesn't go into all of his background, which is really fascinating. I highly encourage you, listener, to go to his website, and all this will be in the show notes, where you can read about his past that led him to the Marines, then to being a monk for 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. In a monastery, and then to San Diego, where you now teach mindfulness and have a sangha and do some fantastic online courses. One of my favorite things are your YouTube videos. So all that will be in the show notes. And is there anything you want to say to that or introduce yourself a little bit?
First, let me just start with gratitude. Thank you so much for having me, Ellen. And I enjoy all of our interactions, so I'm already enjoying this one as well.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, you kind of said it all. Like, there's a lot of stuff at my website at davekeneally.com. You know, you can sign up for a weekly newsletter that I send out about ancient wisdom, modern neuroscience, and Zen. I offer a weekly gathering every Sunday via Zoom, and that's by donation and has a Zen teaching in it every week. All the details for that are there. And I also just am about to finish a 3-month-long course to help people facilitate mindfulness in any setting. And so all the resources and the videos for that are for free on my website as well. So go check it out.
Thank you. Thank you for doing that work. It's so important right now. And that's a little bit of what I had said before we started taping. I wanted to talk about that you have a video that talks about when you hear bad news or when you get really down and out, how to respond to that in a Zen, mindful way. Because, you know, these days, these stories that we're hearing in the news can be so disturbing. And I love this video personally. I love all your videos, but this one was really, really helpful to me. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
I would love to. I would love to, Ellen. Thank you. Mindfulness of the news is always important, but now more than ever. Now more than ever, for sure. The first thing I like to do is to normalize what we're experiencing, right? Because it can feel sometimes like, you know, there's just crisis after crisis, and we don't have any moment-to-moment control as human beings over how we get affected emotionally by some of this news, by a lot of it. And so, very naturally, totally normally, especially if you're tracking the news on a daily basis, as so many people do, now that our supercomputer is in our pocket or more likely in our hand. Yeah. Well, what I see is that, and we were using this term when we were talking earlier, that people are putting themselves, right, by too much news on a constant emotional roller coaster. Mm-hmm. And that's exhausting and can be really harmful. And so the first thing I want to do is just normalize that. Like, just in the way I couldn't drink a 6-pack of beer and not expect to get drunk, right? I shouldn't be consuming lots and lots of news on a daily basis and not expect to be going through really strong emotional highs and lows.
That's a great analogy. That's a great analogy.
Thank you. Yeah, I've had to face it down myself, you know, and continue to, right? Because it's not the kind of thing, it's not like a light switch I can flip and say like, okay, well, I'm just going to divert my attention from that and focus on other things. Because that's not always available to me. My friends are talking about the news. The news comes at me through work things that I'm involved in. I'll hear or see a headline about something and really care to know more about it, you know, because I feel personally connected or outraged. And so here again, I want to start, you know, with yet another normalization. Like, that's totally normal. That's totally normal. Like, biologically, psycho-emotionally, we're a creature that was designed to hang out with like 150 other very close friends and relatives all day. You know, spending most of our time outside, like not getting almost ever news from afar.
Right.
And so this idea now that in that very same brain and central nervous system and emotional makeup, spiritual makeup, that I could know about what billions of people are doing and how billions of people are suffering and not be greatly affected, it's unreasoned. So we're going to be drawn to it, even beyond the fact that, you know, so much of the news that's coming at us is coming at us through capitalist streams, right? It's being marketed and couched and presented in a way that's designed to be as addictive as sugary cereal.
and titillating, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it gets me, you know. I'll have the thought that I want to, you know, post something on my Instagram for people. And the next thing I know, I've been there for a half an hour, like looking at things that I don't like, that I don't need to know, that I don't have any influence over, but that can be very disturbing to me. So I think the first thing we need to do is to forgive ourselves for all that. Because when I talk with people about this topic, what I find is that they're usually in one of two camps. They're usually just inundating themselves with news all the time. And it makes, you know, obviously that makes them feel terrible, you know? Or they're doing the opposite, right? And they've put up a boundary and they've put up a wall and they feel really guilty about it. And they feel like, oh, I'm not doing my job as a citizen. I'm not participating. This is narcissistic, right?
Yes.
And so I meet people that are, you know, on one end, somewhere on that continuum, right? Somewhere in that spectrum. And so the first thing I like to tell people when this comes up is just to forgive yourself, like for whatever choice you've made, for wherever you are right now, given your life circumstances, your upbringing, your personality, and therefore your nervous system's interface with the world. Mm-hmm. Whatever you're doing, normalize it. Like, it's okay. It's not your fault.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, I need it too. I'm saying this to me. And then the last normalization is that we have this idea in our minds, perhaps because of our evolutionary biology and psychology, that things should be pretty good. And when terrible things happen, you know, when atrocities take place or disasters take place, we have a response that's very emergent. Right, especially at an emotional level, right? We get really scared or we get really angry or we get really despairing.
Yes.
And, you know, this again is not our fault, right? This is how we're designed, we're very emotional and very easily influenced by outside influences like a stream of news media. And so we have this response like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. But the reality is in those, you know, more lucid moments when we can take a step back and maybe bring our awareness up to 10,000 feet and look back on the totality of our own life experience alone, save history, we can see from that perspective that these kinds of things happen all the time, that they're, you know, for better and for worse, they're normal. Difficulty, challenge, upset, the unexpected is the norm. And not reminding ourselves of this makes that emotional roller coaster much more severe than it needs to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when the conflict in Ukraine began, I was sitting with my weekly sangha, my weekly mindfulness group, and of course, you know, it was the topic of our gathering. And one of the most poignant questions, perhaps, you know, was around like this feeling of despair, you know, because there was so much helplessness involved, you know, from our perspective as Americans. It was mostly Americans on the call. Like it felt so far away and yet so horrific. And, you know, there was nothing that we could do. And I reminded the Sangha that day, I was like, yes, all of that is true. But yesterday, like the day before Ukraine was invaded, the whole world was at war. You know, we don't hear about it all the time because right. of, you know, the interests behind how our news is disseminated to us. Yes. And, you know, for a variety of reasons. You know? But the reality is, and I know this from my own personal experience in the military, is that the world is at war all the time. You know? And these kinds of atrocities that, you know, right now, for example, as you know, the genocide in Gaza is happening, you know, that we hear about every day. The reality is, you know, if they were happening every day a year ago. And that's not easy to hold, right? That's like a hot rock. Like that hurts to hold that truth. But if we do the work of picking it up every once in a while and reminding ourselves, right, it can help us be less reactionary, right? Because our responses can then be, you know, more appropriate, more tailored to the reality that, like, okay, well, this is how it is and how it's been for a long time. The ideas that I have, the collaborations that I form, the choices in activism that I make are very different when I can hold that greater perspective. And when I don't feel like every crisis is right up in my face, the way my nervous system might be designed to make me feel.
Okay, I'll try that.
Not easy, right?
No, it's not. Well, because I think of a child suffering, you know, in Gaza. I can imagine that mother who has given birth and her child is starving. So it's like you said, we aren't programmed to know everything that's happening on the whole globe, and we do.
Exactly. And so this brings me to what I think is the most important part of how I recommend that people interface with not just the news, but from a mindfulness practitioner's perspective with everything. When I meet people and I start talking to them about their lives and their practice, their service to the world, very often, more often than not, what I see is that the person is taking 80% or more of their energy and directing it outward. And again, like everything we've been talking about, this is not their fault. This is a function of how our society is designed, how our economy is designed, how we communicate, even embedded in our language. Everything is designed to get us to be focused outward, to be looking for the problem and trying to solve it, looking for the problem and trying to solve it. And because our society is set up that way, there are even now a whole set and system of rewards and accolades that this externally focused type A person receives. Those people tend to have bigger titles. Those people tend to make more money, and on and on. But what I see is that then they've only left themselves 20% at best. Like, that's being generous. Usually it's less than 20% of their actual life energy, their actual attention, their animus, all synonyms, is left in reserve for an awareness of the self, for the care of the self. And so people are imagining that somehow those crumbs that they're leaving themselves with their loving attention, their most valuable resource from the perspective of Zen, our attention is all we really have. And so they're leaving so little of their attention for themselves that of course they're going to get burned out. Of course they're going to despair. Of course they're going to get sick, you know, and on and on. Because they're not taking care of themselves. And not in a, you know, champagne and bubble baths kind of way, necessarily. You know? But I mean at a deeper level, like really staying in touch with my deepest intentions. You know, really honoring the fact that I'm not above or under or being affected by the world, but that I am the world. My teacher, the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, said it very poetically, peace in oneself, peace in the world. And so what I invite people to do is, especially if they're the kind of person that I imagine is listening to this right now, you know, I call them folks who like to help so much that it hurts.
Yeah.
Right? Care so much that it hurts. I recommend that whether it be mindfulness or some other practice, that they take up a practice that reverses that proportion. My aspiration is at every moment, all day long, is to be paying 80% of my attention to myself. Much more important to me than any words that I'm saying right now is my knowledge that my feet are flat on the ground. Is my feeling that my palms are a little bit sweaty, right? Because I'm public speaking and there's a tiny bit of anxiety attached to that. You know, and on and on. And what I've seen is that if I put that much energy, very counterintuitively in our culture, if I put that much energy into self-awareness, then healthy self-management just grows right out of that. I start making better choices. I'm much less likely to undersleep and overwork and on and on and on. And then that increased baseline, that increased clarity, stability, solidity, etc., right, makes the 20% then that I bring to the world in the seeming outside, right, that I bring to my work, that my relationships, ooh, it makes those actions so powerful. It makes those choices so clear, so heart-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And so counterintuitively, the more I pay attention to myself and my own needs and my own health and my own energy levels, the more powerfully I show up in the world.
I love that term self-management to replace selfishness, you know, because in our world, some people would interpret what you're saying as being selfish, unfortunately, not because we warp things, you know? So self-management seems very healthy.
Exactly. The way I like to hold it is that self-awareness, the raw data, is what gives me the tools to actually effectively self-manage.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the same way if I was managing a group of others, but I never went to any of their meetings, I never read any of their reports. If I had no data, I'd have no ability to manage them in that project. So it starts with self-awareness, right? Being aware of my own breathing right now, for example, knowing if I'm hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, halt, you know, these very basic, animalistic even, self-awareness. Then I can use that data to actually self-manage. You know, so for example, if I'm consuming so much news that I'm angry every day, but my highest aspiration is to be peace in the world, well, then I have a conflict there, right? And so with that data, because I've observed my persistent anger, I can adjust how much news I'm consuming or where I'm getting it from or what time of the day I read it, you know, just some examples, so that I can self-manage myself into being the peace that I want to produce in the world. This is one of the ways that our mindfulness practice is in and of itself a revolutionary act, is in and of itself an act of service, right? Because if I'm just operating from unexamined and imprisoning habit, not able to grow, not able to take a step back from my own first very strong and usually emotional reactions and dive deeper into the nuance of what's happening in the world and the contradictions and the complexities of it, I'm very ineffective. I'm very ineffective. I quickly end up being just another person who's a part of the problem.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Then you are part of the problem instead of part of the solution.
Exactly. And so by practicing something like mindfulness, where I'm constantly coming back with a questioning, non-judgmental awareness, a classic teaching from Thich Nhat Hanh, from my teacher, the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, is, are you sure to ask yourself that question and then to immediately give the answer no? Because you're never sure, right?
Wow.
You never have a 360 degree view. You can never read the minds of the other people involved. You can never know the full backstory. We're looking at reality through a cocktail straw. We have a very limited data set. And so acknowledging and normalizing that by asking myself over and over again, are you sure? No, I am not. Are you sure? No, I am not. Right? Gives me some of that spaciousness that we're describing, some of that 10,000 foot perspective.
Or pause before a reaction. I'm wondering if you could kind of walk me through, let's say you hear some horrible story on the news, like we all do. I'm going to make something, well, I'm not going to make something up. I'm going to talk about the 4 million children in Africa who are starving. And you hear, walk me through, you hear this, your reaction, how you respond and what your next steps are.
I love it. I'm very happy to. And the first thing I want to say is what I'm going to describe right now, just by function of our language, is going to sound as if it's linear, because I can only say one aspect of it at a time. But I don't actually mean to say that I'm having a linear experience of this. Okay. It's been my experience that all of this is kind of happening at the same time. And the few things that I'm about to talk about are all in mutual support of one another as they co-dependently arise. So one thing that happens is when I get that, exposure to that challenging news, to that triggering news, is that I notice that I have what I call first thought. Right? And first thought is evidence of my historical self. Right? First thought is a product of my upbringing, my trauma history, the development of my personality and my identity, the culture in which I was raised, the language in which I think, because I think differently in English than I do in Spanish, for example. I'm half Latino. My Wow. mother was born and raised in Ecuador. And yeah, those languages are very different, right? In English, we say, I am angry. And in Spanish, we say, tengo enojado. I have anger.
Oh,
it's out there, right? It's less connected to my identity. It's way lighter in Spanish. And that's just one example. And so I get the challenging stimuli, and then I have first thought. And first thought is based on all this old stuff. It's based on the past, right? It's reactionary as opposed to thoughtfully responsive. And so my first job then is to just acknowledge and accept the data of first thought. Like, oh yeah, that is triggering for me. And like, ooh, I do have some history with that. And I have had a tendency to get upset about that in the past, and on and on and on. Right? Not to reject that or try to stop it necessarily, but just to understand where that data is coming from, what it is.
Mm-hmm.
What it is. Okay, that's first thought. And then I try to move to whatever second thought is. And second thought, that more thoughtful response after a bit of pause, which could mean three breaths if I'm, scrolling. But if it's really triggering, it could mean like 3 days,
Yeah.
Some long walks, some calls with friends, anywhere in between there, right? But my goal all the while is to get from first thought to second thought, to say like, well, what do I really care about now? Like, do I want to be the angry protester screaming at the anti-war rally? Like, that makes me feel like I'm at cross purposes. Right? I might have that initial reaction, but really, like, I've protested with the monks and nuns of the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh as a layperson. When I very first started practicing, I heard that they were going to this kind of keep it in the ground anti-war fossil fuel production rally. Mm-hmm. And I went because I was just like fascinated. I'm like, what are the monks and nuns going to do at this rally? Like, how are they going to be? And what we did at their instruction was we waited for like a spacious part of this march that was going to some, oil company's headquarters in some major city here in the United States. And we walked as a group in silence together. Slowly. Right? So even there, right, as we were making our presence, right, we were making it known that we agreed with the cause of that rally.
Yes.
But we were not doing it in a way that promoted more violence, more hatred, more discord. Right? We brought peace to that rally. And I can't tell you, Ellen, like how many people came over to us at different points in that day and just thanked us. And we're like, oh my God, I'm so upset. And this is so triggering for me. And then I look at you guys and there you are, like with half smiles on your faces, like walking in silence.
Right.
And so that's an example of like what it is to shift from first thought to second thought. That's that other way of showing up is more in line with my heart's deepest intentions to be peace in the world. But I'm not going to get there by default. I have to work for it. I have to give myself the time and the space and slow down and bring 80% of my attention into all of my upset and hold it. Hold it like it was a baby and soothe it. Accept it, love it even, right? Because it's part of my humanity.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with my moral outrage. I'd be a monster without it. I'm so grateful for it, even though it's so painful and can drive me to very unskillful action, self-destructive action even.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, you know, once I've done all that work, right, then I try to connect with other people about it. Because I find like the problem that has come my way, it doesn't exist in a bubble. It exists in its interconnectedness, or to use Thich Nhat Hanh's word, its interbeing. Right? He created that word for us.
Mm-hmm.
The problems exist in an interbeing universe where everything is connected and everything affects everything else.
Right.
So my response must be the same. My response must be interconnected. My response must be community driven. My response must have other people involved. And so before trying to figure out what I can do and being so hard on myself as I have the tendency to do, I try to connect with friends, other like-minded people, learn more. Right? And then and only then do I feel like I have enough ground under my feet on the matter, if you will, to take really skillful action. You know? And because I have connected myself to some community on the matter, when I do start to take that action, I'm going to get really helpful, guiding, supportive, and sometimes very critical feedback. You know, but I want that, right? I want that because I don't want to be operating in some bubble or some very small echo chamber.
Do you find that when you connect with other people, you have to be a little bit careful to make sure that you're keeping your energy high and not, you know, getting sucked down to maybe where they are or to inflate something, the anger? Is that a problem ever for you?
Hmm. Only always.
I was really nervous there for a second that you were going to say no. Oh, man.
Inconceivable. Right? I mean, not only am I vulnerable to, or are we all vulnerable to the trap that it feels so good to just complain and bemoan with other people that already agree with us. Right? We have that going on, working against us.
Right.
We also are at the mercy of mirror neurons, right? We are literally biologically designed to feel the feelings of the other people we're interacting with, even if they're not being overtly expressed, and to mirror them. So if somebody walks into the room right now and is furiously angry, right? I'm biologically predisposed to notice that and to become a little angry.
Wow.
And so, yes, I think we're very vulnerable there to lead ourselves, you know, to be the blind leading the blind, if you will.
Like
to,
yes.
You know, to just gather up and then lead ourselves into some difficulty. There are a number of ways to, you know, hit the brakes on that. But one of the ones that I love is also a teaching from my teacher. I'm wearing this brown jacket today because it's a symbol of my being a disciple of the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. So that's why I keep
that.
So I've been studying his teaching, you know, for 25 years.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that he gave us is something he calls the five mindfulness trainings. And if you Google Plum Village, five mindfulness trainings, it'll come right up. And what they are is his expansion and modernization of the five ancient moral precepts of Buddhism, which were, you know, very simple, pithy statements like don't lie, don't kill, don't steal, you know, five of those. But Thich Nhat Hanh seeing like the how much more complex our modern world was, and you know, being able to know what's happening in Africa right now, like on a moment-to-moment live feed basis, for example.
Yes.
And so he expanded and modernized these trainings as a universal or global ethic that people could practice with. And instead of calling them rules or commandments or precepts, you know, things that could be broken or that would be punishable, he called them trainings, right? Acknowledging like, there's no way to practice these perfectly. That doesn't exist. We're human beings, you know? I can have the aspiration to not kill, for example, but I know that I kill a million organisms every time I boil water to make coffee. Or every time I walk across a field of grass barefoot. And so it's not about perfection or right and wrong, right? Those are dualities that pull us apart, just like terms like conservative and liberal do. Instead, they're trainings, they're friends that are designed to keep bringing me back to a self-awareness of how I feel about any issue or any interaction from a moral sense. And to recognize that my response, that my participation has the ability to cause suffering, has the ability to cause suffering. And so if I'm thinking about that all the time, well, then I'm likely to kill less.
My response has the possibility to cause suffering. That's a good thing to remember.
Exactly. Every single one of those five trainings starts with the phrase, aware of the suffering. And then goes on from there.
Oh.
That's the teaching. He's saying, like, when you think, speak, and act, you always have the potential to cause some suffering. And so you need to be pausing, stopping, taking a sacred pause, as I've heard it called, and really checking in with your heart center before taking that action, before having too much of that thinking, you know, before speaking unskillfully.
And so, do no harm. Really, right?
Exactly. You know, but that's so hard in practice that, you know, just like anything, it's easier to do if you slow down. So, you know, so much of what I've been sharing today in answer to your beautiful questions comes down to that. It's like we just have to slow down. The enormity of the suffering in the world around us produces a false sense of urgency. And that false sense of urgency cripples us. It cripples us. When we step back and slow down, right, that urgency is, you know, revealed as a fallacy very quickly. Almost never do we have to rush. Almost nothing important gets done quickly.
Well, also, if we talk about coherence versus incoherence, when we react, we're incoherent, and your energy is incoherent. And like you said, we're a part of the problem.
Yeah.
And then if we take a deep breath and try to get ourselves back into coherence, we're a part of the solution. And that's what I have to think about. I just love the, you know, that's clear for me, but it's hard to do sometimes. I mean, not that we do it all the time correctly, like you said, but I still, yeah, it's, you know, you kind of, it's a spiral. You feel yourself going down and you have to catch it and turn it around. And do you have any tricks for catching it and turning it around?
I love that question. I had this yoga teacher many, many years ago, an amazing master in New York City named Mary Riley Nichols. And she would like get us into this super difficult pose, you know, it was a lot of advanced teachers and yoga instructors in the room. And then she would just walk in between us saying over and over again, enlightenment is just remembering, because I am of a nature to forget. Enlightenment is just remembering, because I am of a nature to forget, because she wanted that in our brains so deeply. So that's the first thing. If I'm being really hard on myself all the time, if I do not have a safe island inside of myself that I can go to where I'm allowed to think anything, where I'm allowed to feel anything, then taking that pause is very difficult to do. Because usually when I take that pause, right, what kind of data am I getting? I'm getting the data from first thought, And first thought, I might be ashamed of first thought. I might be really frustrated that I still have that first thought as my reaction, right? I might wish that I was over it or something like that. There are so many ways that that recognition of a blind spot initially is painful. It hurts. And so the first answer to that is the only way I can have any chance at all of getting decent even at occasionally recognizing, you know, is by making that action really, really safe. Just in the same way, if every time I threw down a yoga mat, I did yoga in front of a mirror and shamed myself in my mind the whole time, I would not become a yogi.
Right.
Well, so self-love, self-awareness is the data that allows for self-management, and skillful self-management is what starts to grow the flower of self-love. Because the more I start to understand myself, the more I can love myself, the more I can accept even my foibles, even my failings, even my strongest reactions. And so what we do is in much safer, less stressful, less triggering moments, like that quiet 30 minutes that I spend sitting every morning before I open my devices, we train ourselves to create that safe space where we just pay attention to how we feel, how it feels to be a human being, what thoughts are roiling through my brain, what feelings are rushing through my nervous system and heart, right? In acceptance, right? Mindfulness practice is a practice in cultivating the acceptance muscle. And then, just like if I did 100 push-ups every morning, when the going gets tough, when things are stressful and I have to like pick the car up off the child, you know, I'll have the strength to do it because I trained when I wasn't under great stress. And so that's the real answer, is not so much what I can do when it's too late and I've already opened the Instagram feed and been horribly triggered. It's what I'm doing every day to plant seeds of resilience, of openness, of thoughtfulness, of are you sure? No.
I'm curious to know, is this a lot harder since you have left the monastery, being out in the world? Was this, I mean, this sounds like an obvious answer, but I don't think that it is. The difference between living in a monastery and living in the world.
Wow. So much to say, but I'll tell one story because you're right. It's not as cut and dried as we might think. It's not like, okay, living in the monastery is easy, being out here is harder, even though there are many ways that that's true. But I recall a time when one of my mentors, a monastic named Taiphup Ho, it means brother protector of the Dharma, beautiful Swedish brother. He was my mentor at the very beginning of my monastic time. And I had spent at this point, you know, 2 or 3 years already living in the monasteries, training, you know, to become a monk. And so I had quieted my mind. I had stilled my body. I had changed my lifestyle, right? My day-to-day routine, so that I had lots and lots, hours and hours of time for contemplation. And all, I had given up social media devices, right? I wasn't trafficking in any electronic communications. I wasn't even emailing people, save, you know, scrolling on a phone. And so what all of that training and that environment did was give me an opportunity to really look at my mind in a way that's almost impossible to do out here with all of this stimulus and all these, the day-to-day, you know, quotidian responsibilities of a householder. And what I saw was how driven I was by habit, how emotional and clouded my mind was, how susceptible I was to dualistic and even, you know, aggressively conflict-oriented thinking, because I had been raised, you know, to think that, you know, this was good and this was bad and these were good people and these were bad people and, you know, this was right and this was wrong, just like we all have been. And I despaired in that moment. I was like, oh, you know, and there I was sitting with my mentor. I had tears in my eyes. I was like, I just don't feel like I'm even in control of my own mind. My mind will think and rationalize things that I very strongly disagree with. My mind will drive me to take actions that I deeply sometimes regret. And I feel like I'm out of control and that I'm being even manipulated by the outside environment and by my upbringing, by my socialization into this, warlike culture. Obviously, I'm particularly vulnerable to that because I was in the military even. And I'll never forget his response. He just put his hand on my shoulder and he was like, "Brother, there's a lot of truth in what you're saying." He was like, "But you can only be really manipulated if you continue to act out of unexamined habit." It's like, "But if you do as you're doing, right, and cultivate the time and the space and the deep and constantly reminded intention to be taking a step back, to be, as I like to define mindfulness, to be paying attention with love, then you have the chance to make much more thoughtful decisions. You have the chance to do radically different things from what might have been your habit." He didn't use these terms, but it's the same as what we've been talking about. You have the chance to move from first thought to second thought, which is freedom, which is nothing short of being free. And this was so heartening to me. And it really gave me the courage to kind of double down and look even more closely and diligently at my mind in a way that wouldn't have been possible, had I been out here answering emails. So easier and harder is my answer.
I see that. That's wonderful. Mm. Well, next time I am triggered, I am going to be aware of that first thought, then maybe take a few breaths and think about that second thought. So now I feel like I have a tool I can use. Thank you so much for that. I know our listeners are going to want to dive into your YouTube videos. I just know it after listening to you. So I highly encourage you to do that. And as we said, everything will be in the show notes. Everything that Brother Dave talked about will point you in the right direction. So thank you so much for being with us. I think this has been really, really helpful information for those of us who are listening to the news and hearing about everything that's happening all over the world. So I appreciate it so much. So grateful.
Thank you, Ellen, for everything you do. And let me just say thanks to all your listeners as well, because I know if they've made their way to this podcast, they're trying to help.
Yes, they're
so
great.
I'm grateful for them.
And as I like to say, we're more powerful together. So that's what we do together. So thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
That about wraps it up for this episode. Remember, you can connect with us in the Facebook group and for live intention holding Inc. Live's daily insight timer offerings, and with me in the Labyrinth Activist Network's Zoom calls. Details of how to hook up with these are in our show notes. And don't forget our main intention for this week, which we'll also put in the show notes. Look out too for our weekly news episode, which we'll be releasing in the next few days. Thank you for listening and for sharing with us and holding intentions. We look forward to connecting again next time. And in the meantime,
thank you, go well, stay safe.
And remember, we're more powerful together.
Impact is presented by Ellen Bince and Clive Johnson and produced by Impact Productions. Our theme music is by Chris Collins and our logo artwork is by Auto Classic. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, or your favorite podcast provider. We're a non-commercial podcast dedicated to people of any faith tradition or none who yearn for healing in our troubled world. Please pass on the word so others may join us in making an impact. Thank you for listening.